So, Bodhisattvas, this morning I thought we might take a look at case 96 of the Book of Equanimity, Zhufeng's disagreement. Zhufeng worked as an attendant of Xishuang. When Xishuang passed away, the community wanted to invite the head monk in the hall to succeed to the abbacy. Zhufeng was not so sure. He said, "I know that seems like kind of the obvious choice. I have to say, though, I have some concerns. Tell you what, would it be all right? I'm going to check in with him. And if it really seems like he has the essence of the teaching, the thing that's liberating, man, I'm all in, and I will totally be his attendant." Then he said to the chief monk, "So our teacher, he would say, cease, desist. Spend 10,000 years in one thought. Be cold ashes, dead trees. Be a censer in an ancient shrine. Be a strip of pure white silk. Now tell me, how is this liberating?" And the chief monk says, "Well, it illustrates the matter of absolute oneness." Zhufeng said, "Well, I don't think that is the liberating part here." And the chief monk said, "You don't think? You don't agree with me? You don't think I can sit in samadhi? Put up some incense." The chief monk then lit some incense and said, "If I don't understand what's liberating about that about the Dharma of our teacher, then obviously I wouldn't be able to pass away and die while this incense is burning. Watch this." So saying, he sat down and died. And as one Sangha member said to me, "That's the worst superpower in the world." So saying, he sat down and died. Zhufeng sat down next to him and, with tears in his eyes, took his Dharma brother's hand and said, "Brother, as far as dying seated or standing is concerned, you got that. But that isn't the liberating part of the Dharma." This is actually a super beautiful koan, I think. And to begin with, thank you. Please keep doing that. To begin with, as Laura pointed out, this even the title of this, Zhufeng's disagreement. This is such, what we might call it. We might call it Zhufeng's respectful disagreement. Zhufeng's courage to attest to what in his deepest heart he sees is true. And this is so important. This is so important for us to, I'm going to say be true to ourselves, but in a very broad way, be true to the truth of the Dharma as we have personally verified it. And in this way, It's not about who's right or wrong and did the chief monk get it or not get it. Zhufeng, he really loved the community. He really loved the Dharma. And the head monk also really loved the Dharma. But Zhufeng felt that he was maybe stuck and that he wouldn't be able to serve the community optimally. And he wouldn't be able to serve the community optimally. And so he went to investigate. This isn't a challenge. This isn't Dharma combat. And it could have gone down. There's many other ways it could have gone down. It could have gone down, and instead of demonstrating the world's worst superpower of dying, he might have elected to demonstrate one of the other superpowers that Buddhas are supposed to have, such as invisibility. And then he would have been, alive at the end of the koan. And Zhufeng could have gone back to the assembly and said, "Guys, I'm really concerned." And the community would either have listened or not listened. And Zhufeng would have either stayed or not stayed. And this is so important. This is so important. And it's especially important one of the ways the Sangha can support the teachers is and the teachers can support each other pointing out when we're wrong. So, and not in a right and wrong sense. So, for instance, at the Greater Boston Zen Center, I make a lot of decisions, and there are certain Sangha members who come to me and say, Josh, I think that we really maybe you're mistaken here. And they tell me why. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for that. That leaves space for me to be the muddled, foolish being I am. And when we're having a And one of the sacred responsibilities of any piece of Dharma transmission is caring for the Dharma. And so, Zhufeng goes to his brother and says, So our late teacher, he would say, cease and desist. Cease and desist from thought, let's say. And spend 10,000 years in one thought. Be cold ashes, dead trees. Be a censer in an ancient shrine. Be a strip of pure white silk. And this sounds so much like our idea of emptiness. This sounds like our idea of oneness. It sounds like a state of mind that is very special and that we can get into. And the fact is, there are special states of mind that we can get into, or some of us can get into, or some of people, not including myself, can get into. And yesterday, Faye brought up the dramatic example of the dude who needed a freezer. And this is something that human bodies and minds are capable of, sometimes, under some circumstances. So is running a Ironman triathlon. I can't do that. And I don't actually want to. And even if I could, that is not what I should be teaching here in the Dharma Hall. There are things that we can do. There are things that we can learn to do. But that is not the essential matter of liberation. And the fact of emptiness, the truth of emptiness, the truth of the absolute, the truth of oneness, isn't a state of mind that feels some way and not some other way. It is the actual fact of the matter. And this is the liberating value of the Dharma. So, if Zhufeng had come to me and said, Josh, so spend 10,000 years in one thought. How do you understand that? I might say, my ass hurts kind of on the third day of Sesshin. And if he said, be cold ashes, dead trees, I might say, and you know, I really envy the people who are sitting right in front of the air conditioner. And I wonder if we could change the... Be a censer in an ancient shrine. Be a strip of pure white silk. Josh, how do you understand that? Man, sometimes I feel like a big mess. This is how I might have responded. But there are other good responses. Another response that the head monk might have had is what we see in another koan somewhere. It's the koan of two wrongs, where the master says to the monk, twice I've said wrong. Now tell me, is it I who am wrong, or is it you? And the monk says, it's me. And the master says, wrong. And then he says, stay with me for this summer retreat. Let's you and I investigate this matter of two wrongs together. And so the head monk might also have said, I feel like you think I don't understand the truth of the Dharma. Thank you for speaking that. Stay with me for this summer retreat. Let's actualize the truth of the Dharma together. So when we spend 10,000 years in a single thought, the truth of that is, my ankle hurts. My ankle hurts. My ankle hurts. Nah, that's just performance art. 10,000 years in a single thought is just this truth, the truth of this moment showing up. The only way the absolute ever arises is as the relative. The only place we ever can point to the one is through the many. And this special state that sometimes happens as a byproduct of Zen practice, where the mind stills, where we really have a sensation of being one with everything, where we really have a vivid image of being transparent to the entire universe, which just passes through us. That is not any more true than, oh my God, I feel like such a mess. Those are both individual arisings, individual expressions of the absolute in the form of the relative. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. You know, which is the most, like, irritatingly baffling line in the Heart Sutra for years and years and years and years. And then at some point, you stick with this long enough, I guarantee you'll come into Doksan and you'll say, I just realized something. Check it out. See, here's what I saw. Form is exactly emptiness. And emptiness is exactly form. How come nobody told me that 5 years ago? And this is part of why we do the liturgy. And we don't hear it until we hear it. And we don't need to hear it. Because even not hearing it, is it already actualized? Another piece that's sad about this koan, when the head monk passes away, it reminds me of this other koan where Master Yunmen, I think it is, says, why did the ancient worthies not stay upon the glorious peak? Or we might say, on the top of the 10,000 foot flagpole. Or we might say, in deep, unmoving, single-pointed samadhi. Why didn't the ancient worthies stay there? And then Yunmen answered himself by saying, because it has no power to save. It has no power in the way. And as we heard this morning, the meaning of Zazen is the enlightenment and liberation of all beings from suffering. This is the power of the way. Coming down off those flagpoles, this is the power of the way. In the cycle of ox herding pictures, 10 things that kind of describe the spiral cycle of the spiritual path, the 10th one is descending back into the town. But don't imagine that the 10th stage comes after the first stage. You know, and I also want to... this samadhi absorption, right, is not something that is a particular part of my practice. I hear it happens to folks. It's not a thing in itself, because snipers can be in absorptive samadhi for hours or days on end. Samadhi is not the thing. Here's a linguistic irony. Zen, our school, the Zen school, this word comes, as I'm sure you've heard, from the Chinese word chan. And this comes from the Sanskrit word, which you usually see written as jhana, D-H-Y-A-N-A. That's the archaic transliteration. The modern transliteration is jhana, J-H-A-N-A. And there are many books on jhanas. Jhanas are these absorptive states. I've edited 3 of these books. When I worked at Wisdom Publications, 3 of those books came across my desk, and I worked with the authors on them. And every piece, and it was profoundly doubt-inducing for me. It was about all of these incredible meditational awareness, and then you do this, and then you have this sign, and you see this thing arise, and then you become even more absorbed, and then you can have an absorption such that, you know, let me tell you a story about the absorption. One time I was so absorbed that people actually took me to the hospital because they thought, you know, they called the ambulance, and then I woke up and you know, like, congratulations, you inconvenienced the healthcare system. Like, we don't have enough problems. And because, you know, our school is called the Zen School, which seems like, therefore, we should be doing this jhana stuff. And one of the things that I notice sometimes happens to the subtlest teachers is that they lose faith in the subtle thing that they have entrusted, that they have found useful, and instead they move towards a kind of more rule-based concrete thing. And it isn't the case that we've, in the Zen school, somehow lost the instruction manual. It isn't the case that you're getting bad instruction in Zazen because your teachers don't understand meditation well enough, or because we don't have the polished and refined and ornate technology of Tibetan Buddhism or of Theravada Buddhism, which is where the jhanas come from. And one of the things about the best jhana books, the very last stage, after you get these incredible meditational attainments, there's a deconstruction phase where the big realization is, and those meditational awarenesses aren't what it's about. And in Zen, we start with that. We deconstruct as we go. And for me, reading these other styles just seems like so much work. It seems so hard. And I'm like on board for hard work, but not unnecessarily. Melissa identified that this koan that we're looking at goes really well with this passage from Chenul's Secrets of Cultivating the Mind. And Chenul is kind of equivalent in the Korean Zen tradition what Dogen is in the Japanese Zen tradition. He is a big deal. To sit rigidly without moving like a rock, crushing grass, repressing both body and mind, trying not to have a body, trying not to have a thought in a mind. To regard that as cultivation of the mind is a great delusion. To regard sitting and passing away in Zazen as cultivating the mind is a great delusion. It has no power in the way. And for this reason, it said, hearers of the teaching, cut off delusion, thought after thought. Cut off delusion, thought after thought. Delusion arises, and they cut it off. Another delusion arises, and they cut it off. But the thing is, the thought that does the cutting is a brigand. It's a thief. It's actually the very same thing as the thought it's cutting off. So a thought arises. Whatever thought arises, maybe it's a thought about good and evil. Maybe it's a thought about a preference for ease and joy over agitation and discomfort. Maybe it's a thought about looking forward to lunch, to sleep. And if we if we respond to that thought with a whole storyline of, no, no, that is the bad thought. Okay, not having that bad thought. I'm instead going to cut it off. Here I go. I'm cutting it. This is me cutting it. Okay, there it is. It's cut. All right, I'm done with that. Phew. Okay, now I'm doing all right. Oh, no, here's another thought. That's actually all the same thing happening again and again and again. The beauty of our non-dual practice, the beauty of receiving all arisings of mind into the same one category, is that we don't have to figure out, we don't have to be trying to decide, is this the right thing to be arising or not the right thing to be arising? And if that figuring out arises for us, we don't have to even cut that off. That's just an arising. All we ever see in the content of consciousness is the kinds of things that arise in the content of consciousness. And the liberation that is actually useful about Zazen is not dependent on any content of consciousness. And this is what Chanul's pointing to when he says their arising would be the same as their non-arising. This thought arises, this thought doesn't arise. Cutting off arises, cutting off doesn't arise. And this doesn't mean that Zazen, that Shikantaza is nothing. But it isn't a content of consciousness. Whenever you notice that you have been for hours on end, minutes on end, 10,000 years on end, feeding the fire of some story you're telling yourself, whenever you see that, you can just desist. Ah, there's that. And Chanul says, do not fear the arising of thoughts. And then he says, only be concerned lest your arising, your awareness of them be tardy. Oh, ah, oh, I might be tardy. Oh, I got that late. Ah. And this is super important with regard to businesses like killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. You want to catch yourself doing those, you want to catch that arising before you act on those. So what I'm saying is don't accidentally murder people. And this is how the precepts function. The precepts say, all right, you need to pay particular attention to these 10 things. If you find yourself doing these 10 things, look. But as far as this awareness is tardy, awareness is never tardy. Awareness comes when it comes. And before it comes, it hasn't come. And if we are aware of the thought the moment it arises, then through that awareness, it will vanish. This sounds like we only have this one microsecond shot of being aware of it as it arises. And then if we are, then phew, then we win and it vanishes. But if we don't, then we're, oh man, there's nothing I can do. But the awareness, it's actually when the awareness of, boy, I've been talking to myself for the last 5 minutes about whatever. When that arises, the whatever you've been talking about to yourself has already vanished. And what's here now is a story about those moments. And you can just see that and resume the entrusting yourself to Zazen, upright and unmoving in the midst of all that comes, upright and unmoving in the midst of whatever goes. If lovely states arise, we meet them with no preference for them. If terrible states arise, we meet them with no aversion to them. If preference for lovely states arise, we meet that with no aversion to it. The way is actually really wide and generous, really supportive, really encouraging, and really, really trustworthy. And as for this matter of 10,000 years in a thought, this matter of ashes after the fire, a withered tree, let's look into this matter together. So, here is our Dharma dialogue, an invitation to come forth, to resonate, to inquire, to look into. And those of you who haven't practiced Zen elsewhere than Boundless Way, I want you to know that this thing we do, this Dharma dialogue thing, is actually very special and very unusual. Those of you who've only practiced in Boundless Way think this is the way Zen goes.
Strikes me that the chief monk died.
Oh, can't hear you in the back.
It strikes me that the chief monk died and that he chose to die. And I guess there are sort of two threads to this. One is that it reminds me of the passage excerpt from the liturgy book about those who are who greatly realize delusion, and there are those who are greatly deluded about realization. And so the obvious thing would be that this action is that he's showing that he's greatly deluded about realization. Because he thinks realization comes with death, which is actually sort of breaking all of the precepts but I'm really curious about, so Zhufeng was, just can you remind me, was he the person who was the attendant to the former teacher, the late
mm-hmm.
teacher,
right.
was then put in the position of the teacher? No.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Initially.
The community thought the head monk should succeed
mm-hmm.
the abbot. Zhufeng, who was the abbot's attendant
right.
and was following him around all day and, you know, helping him out, had a disagreement about
mm-hmm.
that.
And then after the head monk passed away,
yeah.
somebody else succeeded. So I'm sorry, I'm not really getting to it, but I'm really, really wondering about how Zhufeng was feeling, knowing that his disagreement, in part, one of the consequences of that was that someone died. And then just...
Yeah. That's really beautiful. That's really beautiful and really important. And that's why in my retelling of the koan and the way I envision it, I see Zhufeng going, oh, taken his hand. Oh, brother. No, not that. And that head monk died to teach us here today in Worcester on Monday. And that monk gave his very life for us, to remind us that this is it. What a bodhisattva action.
Maddie, you said that the head monk died, made a choice to die. And I'm not sure that that's really the case. It seems to me that it was more reactive. He needed to prove something and actually had no choice there. And this is exactly what we are looking at here when we sit, how these underlying beliefs or, I guess in his case, the need to be right, how they drive us if we don't notice it. And in this case, with devastating results.
So it's kind of the gift that keeps on giving, in a way. His, you know, if we look into, well, wanting to be right, that's wrong. We're missing the point, too, that our hearts need to actually open to this part of ourselves that wants to be right. And something underneath that trusts, really trusts, that the energetic force behind that is innocent and must come forward. So that's why we love this guy, you know, caresses his shoulder, holds his hand, pats him on the back, all these different ways, but it's contact. He touches his Dharma brother. We touch each other. And just for clarity's sake, Jufang succeeded Shishuang. After this happened, the community rose up and said, huh, okay, well, I guess not him, because he's dead. How about you? How about you? And he bowed, like he would have bowed if something else had happened. He was ready to bow to the head monk. Instead, he bowed to the community. So something coming up for you, you want to give voice to?
I have a real strong aversion to the idea that death is that death arises in a way that causes great pain. I have an aversion to the idea that that is a gift or a thing that is ultimately for some purpose and.
It's easy to hear that, it's easy to hear that, and it's really important that we're not saying that, and you know, in a way, this is using all of the ingredients of our life, using all of the ingredients of our life and death, using all of the ingredients of the life and death of others.
Perhaps there's also the gift that we give to him by learning from his example, validating what he did.
Finish what you're saying.
That was basically
it. The other thing is that these are stories. You know that actual transmission in monasteries was not determined by a vote of the monks. There were actually very complex rules, and there were authorities beyond. So we don't know actually what happened. The truth of this story is the life and death of our lives. And this is not... So I think to say he died so we can learn a lesson sounds a little bit in a way that I don't think this is about us profiting from someone's death. And people die. And our best efforts, so Zhuifeng, in this narrative, somehow was implicated in this death. And I think the truth of no matter what our intention is, there are terrible things that come about, even from our best intentions. And I think there is a truth to that that is undeniable, and we should, cry. It is appropriate when our action leads to some harm. And your actions, my actions, will lead to harm. There's no way out of that. And so all we can do is do our best. Because we cannot prevent harm from happening. And we would all love to, also want to act in a way that is pure. If I am pure enough, if I am clear enough, no one will ever be hurt. And this will not happen.
And responding with grief to deaths, this is the expression of this is the deep teaching, that when people close to us die, we hurt.
And just to continue this a little bit more, I mean, you can see how...
It's still hard to hear.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. I can shout, but I can't really think when I shout. I'm so sorry.
Let's turn off.
Let's turn it off, yeah.
Mark,
it's sorry. Okay. So this is important, too. It's very important for us to be allowed to have our own response and reactivity, including the yearning to go and comfort. There's nothing wrong with that either. But it's part of our guidelines, yeah, to stay with ourselves. The part of... Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. The part of Josh's talk that I feel relates very much to this, and it's a little bit of a theme we've been going into, is this thing about whenever awareness arises, that's the right moment for it to arise. And there's way too much. Life is so complicated. We can have the best intentions, as David said, and the result is disastrous. We just don't have enough information. But whenever the awareness, it's never tardy, whenever it arises, that's the moment when we get to, that's when the learning happens. So I know in my life when people have died through horrific things, even self-imposed stuff, it's horrible for a long, long time. And the awareness that arises at that moment is, oh, and that's all I can do. And then it shifts and it changes and life goes on. And this is the promise of this practice. Continual awarenesses arise and nothing gets cut off. And even cutting off is it too. This is hard to wrap your head around. So everything that's happening right now, this is it. No mistakes. And totally wrong. Thank you. So Alan had his hand up, and he saw a bunch of other people.
So what? One of the great things about the week-long sesshin is we get to spend so much time with the koan, and every day it changes, you know, and different parts of it come out, and it turns a new face to it, and I was really struck listening to you, Josh, with how, you know, this, for me at least, this koan started out seeming really weird and exotic and kind of, well, you know, cultural relativism. This was such a different time and, you know, people could die while incense burned and they, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's become so much more human, you know, and so much more about us. And I really appreciated the way that your retelling was all about bringing it, letting us be really intimate with it, and not that's another time and place. And I was struck with how, you know, yesterday when David read it and read the commentary, I was struck how even at the end of the commentary, you know, there's this line about if you let these fantasies go, then a single step is a flying dragon with here with a single step. Do you know that line?
In the verse.
Sorry. That beautiful verse.
Three more days.
Cutting off the 10 directions still gets a failing mark. Quietly move a step, and behold, a flying dragon.
Right. And so what I wanted to say is that the flying dragon isn't different from the step. You know, these wisdom dragons aren't in some magical Buddhist cave somewhere.
Right. Show me taking a step and beholding a flying dragon.
if there are wisdom dragons, they're right here, right? If the Buddha was enlightened, it didn't happen 2,600 years ago. It's happening right now, right?
I might say, knee hurts.
It does.
How about Carolyn?
I really want to thank you for making this all much clearer. It was a very nice talk and really focused a lot on what we are all trying to do here, which is really helpful to put it in such clear, simple language that nothing is really it or not it, but they're all, everything that comes up. And yet, I'm also thinking a lot about the precepts last night and the connection between these two aspects of our practice is always somewhat bewildering to me, because I certainly have the sense, even though to some degree undermining that we do think that the awareness helps us to actually make decisions differently, that being aware of something, you know, stop, think about it, or even notice it before you just act without being aware of it. And yet I'm also aware that even recognizing it doesn't necessarily take the power away from it. Sometimes it does.
Right.
Sometimes that thought so distorts our view of ourselves, of others, of reality, that even if we can sort of see it and say, oh yes, there's that thought again, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not still under the sway of it.
So
how do you then get to the point of knowing what you really do think you should do or not do when these things still have so much power over you?
You're making a whole bunch of excellent points, and I'm gonna tease them out a little bit. One, that you're hearing that the teachings of the precepts sound like one thing, and the teaching of there's nothing that's it or isn't it sounds like another thing. And here's the reason they sound like that. It's because that's true, and it's not true. And the precepts are so important to the Zen tradition, because without them, then we become unmoored in this, hey, it's all one, so I'm a samurai and I'll chop off your head. It's all one, so I can have sex with all my students. It's all one. There's nothing that's it or not it. Right? That is a path to being a demon. And we need to be moored, anchored by the precepts, and we screw up, and we can't. Sometimes we're caught, and while we're caught for as long as we're caught. But here's something we can notice: is that for all, and we get uncaught when we get uncaught, and it's either sooner or later. It's either 5 thoughts in, 4 years in, 25 years in. In our dying breath. But in that moment, that's all of it. So, no easy answers, and the mess of human lives and human minds, and doing our best with using the tools, like sitting still in Zazen. It's not a thing we're trying to do. But doing this, naturally, what happens is, oh man, I've been telling myself a story for 7 days now. Or so this allows those things to arise. The precept ceremony, the recitation of the precepts, these, and reading Dharma books, all of these are practices that can increase the likelihood of us being able to notice.
One thing about what you said, Carolyn, that strikes me is that I think we have the idea, and I think the Chenul reading, unfortunately, the way it's phrased or translated, who knows, points to it. And Josh pointed this out in the talk, is that we get the sense that it's a automatic release. So awareness means gone. And even though we hear, no, really it's not that simple, we hold in our hearts that wish. If only, because I've seen this pattern a billion times, and it's supposed to go away, and it hasn't. So now I know that this teaching is false. Right? That's the proof. And I always like to quote the great Zen master, unfortunately he died recently, Harold Ramis, who some of you might know was the director and screenwriter of Groundhog Day. And in that story, which he's very specific in his teaching, if you haven't seen Groundhog Day, then that's your assignment for when you leave Sesshin, but please don't stream it on your iPad or iPhone during Sesshin.
Because people here yeah. stream on...
Stream it on my iPhone. Oh, I will do that. Didn't she say that? Keep them off. The teaching in that, which actually derives from a very similar teaching to this, is that you have to live these patterns a billion, quadrillion times without any hope of them going away and get to know them thoroughly. And in Groundhog Day, in the story, if you've seen it, the main character transcends his suffering. And you know, the ordinary mind sees that happen and goes, whoa, tomorrow is going to be the day after. And it isn't. It's one of the best parts of that movie. It isn't the next day. He's still stuck. That's how it works. And then, finally, when he's given up the idea of something working, and this is, you can't make it, you can't make things happen, right? You can't undo things with your intentionality. This is where the heart of true and trusting comes in. Then he's released, but only then. So you can't even say, oh, I get it, so I just have to give up. There's no strategizing this. It's really important to know that. And so this is a group of people who have decided, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this not doing. I'm going to be with my life as it is and see what happens. And one of the things we see that happens is we cling to the wish that we'll be released.
Well, we still have to live by the preset somehow, even if the Zazen doesn't get us there.
That isn't connected to what I was saying, but Josh has a response to you.
Well, that's... So the other great thing about Groundhog Day is he clarifies for himself that even though he's living this day over and over again, and even though being kind to each person he sees doesn't matter, doesn't make him not stuck, he clarifies for himself that it goes better for him, that's the person he wants to be. It matters or not, it saves him or not, it doesn't, but he does it anyhow. And this is this practice. This is the practice of failing. This is the practice of returning to our aspirations and the guidance of the precepts, falling short, acknowledging that, atoning by being at one with the big mess we've made, again, returning to our aspirations.
And the point I just want to clarify is we don't have to follow the precepts.
I was thinking more about it actually in terms of wanting to.
Okay. Yeah, very different
thing. It is
very
different, yeah.
And I think so important that we don't So here's the code and the fire.
Right. Yeah.
But
yeah.
They're rather pointing to experience of human beings that we might notice when we do this for the umpteenth time. It still doesn't seem to get us what we want. So, Christine and Steve?
Who had their hands up? Oh, and is somebody over back there?
Doug,
okay. Christine, Steve, and Doug.
So until Kate said about the reactivity, in that moment, I learned more about my own reactivity, because when I first heard about the reaction of the head abbot, I felt, I could see a reactive part of me in that, and I pushed it away because I don't want to see that part of me. So the reactive part of me that I can see is that I'm like, you know what? You shouldn't have questioned me. I'm going to show you something that I was the right one, and then you're going to lose me because you shouldn't have questioned me, but it's too late. You've lost me anyway. And I'm like, oh, geez. So I have, calling that forth helps me see it more when I'm tempted to go in that reactive direction, even in my thoughts and in the story that comes. Embarrassing though it is.
And well expressed in the service of all of us here.
So following up a little bit on what Christine was saying, so that part of it is very much the way that I see it. I can really identify with this, head monk being challenged like that, and I'll show you, I'm going to die, and then you'll all be sorry, I'm gone, I've had that very thought. How dare they do that to me? They're going to be sorry when they see the result of their and it's such a sad story, that the head monk is in that position where, this challenge was enough to push him to that. It's very sad, and the way it came up for me is that we don't really know what Jufeng's intention was here, right? And I imagined myself in the role of Jufeng as well, and the way I saw it myself is that perhaps I was a young attendant here, and I had just a couple of days ago had this realization that maybe, this emptiness thing wasn't the be-all and end-all, and that I would challenge the head teacher with my new understanding of, that I'm going to present words from our late teacher that sound very much like he's talking about, emptiness and thoughts for one thought for 10,000 years and dead trees and cold ashes, and see what he makes of that, right? And maybe he was being an asshole about it, and he's saying, I'm just an attendant and you're the head monk and blah, 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 blah. And then the head monk goes and dies as a result. I mean, how would I feel if I had been an asshole to this guy and I was testing him and he killed himself over my challenge? Oh my God, And that the community may have... Now, I didn't know this part about how, that he later became the abbot, but they could have... He was taking quite a risk here. I mean, he could have been driven out of the community, much like in the story of the sixth ancestor when the guy, speaks, and the monks are angry and they toss him out, and that could have very well have happened here, right? I think the reason why we celebrate this story is not about so much right and wrong. It's that this guy, for whatever reason, was willing to present his understanding, right, and say, I don't see it that way. What about, answer me this, and he, the fact that it turned out so badly is hugely unfortunate. But we still talk about this story. So.
Yeah, and it's a high stakes business. life. You know, it's a high-stakes business opening our mouth. It's a high-stakes business trying to talk from our heart to people about the matter of life and death. And this is one of the things, and we don't always do it skillfully, and God knows we don't always feel like we do it skillfully. And one of the ways that the teachers support each other is by helping us do this terrifying work kind of together.
And you know, I loved hearing your interpretation of this. Steve felt very personal. This, and this is what something Alan pointed to earlier, these koans are not meant to be some abstract, culturally relative story, but we wade through that. That's like the tall grasses. And we get to this, and nobody has the correct interpretation of any koan, but once we start relating to it on this level, the teachings come forward out of it. And you might hear Steve's interpretation and think, oh, I didn't see it like that, so I better think about it again. Instead, you think with your heart. You know, where do I relate? Who do I relate to? What's the main point of this? You know, and then on one level, Jufeng left the head monk alone. That's another point. Or he, you know, challenged him, which is the point that that has been brought out a couple of times. So many things happen in that koan that are like mirrors for us. I think that's why it's so rich. And almost all of them have that richness if we let them resonate in our hearts. You know how to do so well.
Doug.
We talk about the head monk wanting to be right. I don't feel that quite captures it. What I feel the head monk is experiencing is he wants to end his trouble. Another way of putting it is he wants control over the situation. And when we learn one way to get control over situations is to be right. You know, you screw the light bulb in the right way, you get light. You have control. Your troubles of darkness is over. But what has happened here is he's made a rash judgment about being right. If he really wanted to be right, he would have engaged the attendant's question. But he runs off on this rash judgment saying, here, I'll prove it. And he uses his superpowers.
Well said, Doug.
Yeah, thank you, Doug.
Yeah, and I'm reminded of something that David brought up recently. He said, do you want to be right or do you want to be in relationship? And this is the business of all of us being in relationship to any of us, of meeting other people.
Going back to Maddie's response, I'm pretty old, I'm 65, and the idea that when the time came I could light a stick of incense and die at the end of the stick sounds very lovely to me. So I kind of see in the head agate fear. He's fearful. And yes, he's trying to get control. Because he's fearful, he's had something laid out as an opening, a possibility that he could then enter. And he doesn't know how to do this. He doesn't know how to enter this. And he doesn't say, I don't know, or what we kind of, at least I think we stress in the boundless way practice of bringing the real experience of your heart into these questions that come up in these tests. And he can't do this. He simply can't. And I think there's a sense of fear here. What do I have? What am I losing? And really, when it sort of jumped in my mind to this whole idea in our society that we can control how we die. We can have a good that we have some control here, that we can control pain. And in fact, we can't control pain. Sometimes we can, but my mother died in great pain, and I watched her die. I wish I'd had a stick of incense that she could have just gone into samadhi that way. After she died, I asked friends, is there any way I can stop that morphine? Because when I have to go, I don't want to do it. But we can do these things. We don't have that control. I guess it goes back to what Kate said about how much control, how much choice is involved here. It's an interaction between Zhufeng and the head abbot, and we don't really know what all of the other things and conditions and everything are there that create this scenario, that have this particular outcome. We don't have that. We just don't know. So I guess that's
thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
I'm so embarrassed. Feels like an old friend. I don't know what to do. I'm so embarrassed.
Mama. Both of us have a similar impulse, I think. Your teacher of the day.
Let me tell you what I see. Let me tell you what's arising for me. I'm so inspired by your courage. You are so vividly demonstrating humanity. And I actually can honestly, so you've sitting right in front of me, and so I've been witnessing you in the process of Oryoki all week, and I've seen how beautifully, I saw how painful it was for you in the beginning, and I saw how much you were struggling, and I've seen you work with that and meet it again and again, meal after meal, step after step. And it has actually been a great help to me. holds. And not to say that you're doing that for me. Not to invalidate your experience in that way. But I want you to know, in all honesty, that's what arises on my side.
And I just might add to your question, I don't know what to do. You are doing it perfectly. I am really impressed. Now, this is not to say now you're all going to think, oh, I should do that. I should. No.
I'm not crying enough.
I'm not crying enough. I want to impress them. But this is the point. And this is very related to the koan, folks. You know, that we have to come forward as ourselves. We don't have to fix other people. We don't have to correct. We don't have to think we know what Mark is going through. We just have to witness our reactivity. It's amazing. It's such a big learning. And then to speak this inner thing that we all struggle with is the icing on the cake. You know, to really, awareness has arisen. And we don't have to do anything about it. It doesn't need to be fixed. We're kind of reassuring you. Maybe that's a little extra. Right? Yeah. It's nice. He likes it.
I'll say it.
Yeah. I'll take it. I'll take what I can. But in a way, you know, Zhu Feng was doing something very similar. The consequences were severe. But it was one of those many risks he took. A kind of trust in a way. Who knows? But I gotta say, I trust you, Mark.
Thank you all.